A long, long time ago, I can still remember how that music used to make me smile. And I knew if I had my
And welcome
chance,
back to Success Made to Last. I'm Rick Tokini. Our very special guest on today's songwriter series is Hall of Famer Don McLean. He is debuting a video on YouTube showing us tips and helpful hints on playing guitar. In 2021, he will be celebrating his 50th anniversary of his smash hit, American Pie, that resides in the Library of Congress National Recording Registry. It was named one of the top five songs of the 20th century. Number one song was Over the Rainbow. Number two was White Christmas. So you know where that ranks. His songs have been sung by some of the greats, including Madonna, Garth Brooks, Josh Groban. But we love him most for the songs that he sung, like Vincent, Castles in the Air, and of course, American Pie. Don, it is an honor to have you on Success Made to Last today. Welcome, sir.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, congrats on your fantastic career. Don, who are some of the great influencers of your music?
Well, it started really with the records that I was hearing, like every other teenager in the 1950s. And then I think Elvis Presley impressed me because of the, you know, the way he looked and the guitar he played. He played like a Martin guitar. I think it was a D-18. And then I had a friend who lived around the corner from me, and he was taking guitar lessons, and he helped me start to play my first few chords on the guitar, you know, E, A, B7. And so at that point I was singing and playing a little bit. But he also did another thing for me. He had a lot of records that he had, and I heard like jazz players like Johnny Smith, and I heard Carlos Montoya, the flamenco player, and I heard Sabicas also, and I heard, you know, a lot of different things. Josh White, he had an album called Josh at Midnight, which is still one of my favorite records. So he turned me on to, and then of course he was a guitar player and played a lot of Ventures songs, you know, and every now and then, once I got my rhythm playing going, I'd be in like in one of his groups, and then we'd practice in his basement, you know, and go around and do all these songs. Like we used to have Caravan, Pipeline, all these rock and roll tunes, and we'd play dances. And I would just play rhythm guitar, you know, with those 15. Mm-hmm. So that was the first awareness of all kinds of music that was out there, you know. And, of course, I kept with that and had my own interests. I love all the black groups that sang rock and roll in those days, the Five Satins, you know, the Orioles, the Flamingos. You name it. I loved all those songs and still do. They're still my favorites. You know, and then, of course, I got into Buddy Holly a lot. I loved the guitars again. And there was a group in New Rochelle. They were called the Orchids. And they would play the Buddy Holly stuff at dances. And the guy playing electric guitar would play the same notes. You know, so if you saw Think It Over, he played the same break that Tommy Alsop plays on that record. So I could watch his hands, you know, play, and it was a pretty exciting time, you know, because it was all a mystery to me.
That's beautiful. And I watched the YouTube and noted that Hugh McCracken and even Pete Seeger influenced your work.
Oh, when the folk thing hit me, you see, I kept... The rock and roll thing was first, and of course there was pop music before that, and then the folk thing happened, and I fell in love with the Weavers were blacklisted, and I had my attempted later on to meet them and got to know them. And because of that, as a teenager, I ended up being managed by their manager.
Oh my God.
For a year or so, when I dropped out of school, I was 18. I traveled all around the country singing in little nightclubs, such as they were, you know. They were little coffee houses, really. And so my odyssey is a little strange, because it was all really based on me knocking on doors and having the doors open. And, you know, finding a friend like that in Marichal to show me these different musicians. And then having the Leventhal office represent me and teach me a little bit about how the business worked, because it was a mystery. You know, people didn't really know how show business worked, especially the music business.
Don, your music is so accessible to everyone. When I learned to play guitar in 1975, the very first two songs I learned were American Pie and Vincent. Did you write the songs purposely to make them accessible?
Well, I think the reason it was accessible is I'm pretty simple in terms of what I understand. So I just was, you know, reflecting the influences that I had, which were pretty basic.
So let's talk about the next generation. Is technology detrimental to young songwriters?
Young people have their ability to concentrate is
yep.
damaged by being on the phone all the time, on the computer all the time, going from one thing to the next, and never really solidly staying with something and grappling with it over a month or a week or 2 months or whatever to get a song. That's what it takes. Most people want instant gratification now.
That's true. We agree that our nation has ADD. When you came out with American Pie, you actually were a nonconformist with an 8-minute song versus 3 minutes the normal play. Tell us about your position as a nonconformist.
Well, that's just that's rudimentary. I mean, I don't think in commercial terms. I'm not a commercial artist. You know, that was, my hits have all been somewhat flukish, because certainly, you know, I would have written songs that were hit type songs and made hit type records, and I never did that. I was always interested in ideas and trying to get the idea out there, and the fact that I had some success with 8 or 9 songs or maybe more that were in the top 40 is a miracle. I mean, I have no idea how that happened, because I was out there doing my own thing. And but I'd go in, you know, and I'd write a song. Let's say, I'm going to write a song. I always wanted to write a song about like the pop songs were that I heard in the 50s on the radio when I was a little boy in Marichal. And so I wrote "And I Love You So," and I wrote others. "Empty Chairs." Vincent is actually like that, but it's a little bit farther away lyrically. But I mean, lyrically, "And I Love You So" is one of those songs, type of thing that a pop singer would sing. So I end up, well, when I would go in the studio, I'd say, "Well, I need a string section," and because, well, why? Well, because I'm going to do this song, and I want it to sound like I want it to sound. So that's how I would do it. And normally a producer would say, well, look, you know, you're basically working with the acoustic guitar and an ensemble and maybe some, you know, electric lead and, you know, but, you know, a big string section is, you know, not necessary. But I would have to say, well, it is, because that's what I'm going to do. So it was a lot of difficulty getting away. Even when I worked with Larry Butler, you know, one of the great Nashville producers, you know, I made 2 records with him, but if I'd made any more records, it would have had that same sound, and I didn't want to do that. So, you know, I was always looking for a different direction or a different idea, you know, and a lot of times it was a struggle you know, to get the producer to realize that, number one, I was the boss, and number two, you know, do what I tell you. You're going to be happy because it's not going to sound like all the other records you make.
Well, exactly. And we're so glad that you're different. Hey, would you mind seeing the front end of Vincent? And I've got a short story to tell you.
Well, it goes, starry, starry night, paint your palette blue and gray, like that.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, let me tell you the story. Every time I visit a museum that has a Van Gogh painting, especially of one starry night, I'll stand in front of that painting and sing Vincent. And almost every time someone comes and joins me and sings along Vincent with me.
Oh, that's so funny. I didn't know that. That's a really nice little story.
It's an ultimate compliment to you. Hey, I'm sure you watched the TV show Songland, where you get to see how songs are developed. To that end, tell us about the origin of the beautiful song Vincent.
Well, first of all, a lot of what I do is it comes from psychic and emotional pain. There were things going on in my life back in those days that were very uncomfortable, and I was in a lot of pain, emotional pain. So, you know, that's, I think, why I related to the idea of even attempting to do a song about Vincent Van Gogh in the first place.
Okay.
And I had read a book about him by his brother, and the brother apparently had the same illness that Van Gogh had. His name was Theo. And the idea occurred to me, because I was always reading a lot in those days, about 1970 or 69. And I just said, well, I wonder if I could just write a song about him. So I used the painting Starry Night, and that's how I think I got close to him, was by taking his very personal artistic expression and morphing it into lyrics. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the trick was finding a nice melody. I'm fairly good at writing melodies, and that's important because, you know, lyrics are just important. You have to have both, you know. And then you've got to make a good record. And I had a good producer named Ed Freeman, and made a beautiful record, and that's why we're talking about the song.
And with the release coming out from Time Life in 2021, will all of the songs on the 11 albums be remastered with any bonus tracks?
They'll all be remastered. They'll all be spruced up. They'll all be ready to go. There'll be, I guess there's graphics with every one of these records. There are bonus tracks. In the fall, there's going to be another 20 wild tracks under the title of Songs from the 90s that were not released and some that were. And there's also going to be a couple of videos, Manchester video, live in Manchester. And a concert I did with Nancy Griffith and Garth Brooks called Starry, Starry Night, or PBS, which I own, and that will also be put out in the fall, along with a box set and a new album. So there's going to be a whole lot of stuff on me, and there'll be stuff coming up during the summer, you know, maybe a single off the album.
We really do need you in concert again. America needs this jolt, and we think America has this abundance mentality. Tell us about why you think it's important for young songwriters to do their homework, match up with the right singer, and then let their music go to others, almost in an unselfish, abundant-like manner.
Well, one of the things that I think that you need to do as a songwriter is you need to know a lot about other people's music that are in the areas that interest you. You just can't start singing a few country songs and say, well, I'm going to write, you know, write a song. You can write a song, of course. You can do that from any perspective. But if you want to keep going and you want to have a style and you want to invent something that lasts a long time, I mean, basically, I invented Don McLean. You know, I invented the music. I invented the sound. I invented the way I look. I invented the way I act. I invented that guy. Mm-hmm. And everybody has to do that if they want to be a performer. And if you want to take it a step further and be a songwriter, that's another artistic endeavor. So you need to know about a whole lot of other music. Number one. Number two, you need to know about that music so you don't write things that are rip-offs without realizing it. Because a lot of times you come up with a good idea, then you don't realize you heard that in somebody else's song. That'll get you sued. You take a look at Garth Brooks or Bob Dylan or some of these people. They know a lot about music. They know a lot about artists and what they do. They're very familiar with many, many artists and the songs that they sing. That's a very important thing. You've got to put good ideas and good melodies in your head and not garbage. If you put garbage in your head, you're going to get garbage out of your head.
Well, you've got this willingness to give your songs to artists. When you hear others sing, what's important for you to hear someone else singing your song? Or for you to hear you perform them?
Well, I'm usually very impressed with what the artist did with the song, and I say to myself, wow, that's a whole lot better than my version. And, you know, it's nice to hear what Elvis Presley did with And I Love You So. I mean, I thought he did it beautifully. And there's a couple of slight chord changes in there as well. I think Chet Atkins actually put those chords in there when he cut the big hit with Tony, Perry Como in the mid 70s. He put an A7th in the song and it makes a difference. And that's the kind of thing that people in Nashville would do. You know, they had Acuff Rose. What was his name? Acuff was Roy Acuff, but Rose was, I can't think of the guy's first name, but anyway, it wasn't Axel. Okay. That Rose, used to listen to Hank Williams songs, you know, and then he'd go to the piano and he would soften those changes, you know, and he would make subtle chord changes, and that would commercialize the song. So, you know, if you heard Hank doing, you know, "Day you passed me on the street and my heart fell at your feet, I can't help it," you know, and then he'd put these, "Day you passed me on the street and my heart fell at your feet," there'd be a lot of different chords under there, and therefore that would commercialize that song, and some pop singer would come along and say, "Well, I'll sing that of it." That's how Tony Bennett did, you know, "Cold, Cold Heart." Mm-hmm. So country music, you know, you always need these people. And, of course, Chet Atkins was an architect of the modern country sounds.
Well, just a few more questions for our special guest, Don McLean. In Botanical Garden, you wrote a song about a man that waved at you every day. Tell us more about that.
Well, I was on a writing jag. And he was there every day. I have a home in Camden, Maine. I'm not there that much anymore, but he was outside of the funeral home, and now he's passed away, and the funeral home got sold. But for probably 10 years, I guess, maybe less than that, every time I came up the road, back from the road, back home, he'd wave at me. And every time I left to go on the road, he'd be there waving at me. And he used to wear his, you know, military cap, and he'd be out there. And he kind of fascinated me after a while. And so I decided that I would try to write a song about him. And I fantasized, you know, why he waves and who he's waving at. Does he wave Does he wave goodbye to the life he led, or does he wave hello to the one ahead? And the funny thing was, you know, I go on stage when I do the song, I get the audience starts waving, you know, and it's funny because I have people come up to me and say, you know, we've got one of them in our town. So there'll be a wave. They're waving men all over the country, you know, retirees or folks that were in the military or whatever. They just want something to do. So they go out and have a smoke and wave at people.
Yeah. That tickles me because when people go to your concerts, it's not just a concert. It's almost like you are linking arms with them. And even when you look back on some of the YouTubes from the 70s, it's like people would lower their voice to sing with Don, and then they would wait for you to harmonize with them. And so it was it's that engagement. And when you are out entertaining, you may or may not, I'm sure you realize it, but it's like you're on stage with Don, and it's a big deal. And it's that intimacy of you as the entertainer taking your songs forward. And we own, as a public, a nation, we own American Pie in our own heart. Does that make sense?
That's a beautiful thing to say. I can't let you know how nice that is to hear. And I always wanted to do something good for people. That's why I didn't want to have a job and work for anybody. I didn't want to work for anybody because I didn't want somebody telling me what to do. I couldn't do that. And I didn't want to have any kind of, there was no profession that suited me. Because doctors tell people, they're sick, and lawyers tell people they're broke, and, politicians trick people and all that stuff. I don't want to be any of that group. I wanted to be a free radical that circulated in the body politic around the country, and saw what I saw and wrote what I wrote, and I wanted it to be useful for people. So it's, again, combining the rock and roll, folk music, and old-fashioned pop music. That's what pretty much I'm all about, and that's what I understand. And one of the nice things about folk music is that it's useful for people. Mm. That's why they have lullabies and work songs and angry songs of protest. And that's why they have funny, meaningless songs and counting songs and baby songs, all kinds of things that help people. So that aspect has always stayed with me.
Yeah, it's beautiful. That's what makes you so unique and one of our favorites of all time. Okay, so I have to get this question in for the many bands that I've been in. I've been in bands for over 50 years as a drummer and happen to pick up guitar. And I'm going to dedicate this particular question to Dan Wright, who was the lead singer of our band in Boulder, Colorado. And it's about forming the great chemistry of a band. And inside this is the question of, what advice would you give to bands today about managing the chemistry of a band that is basically voices, tone, beat, and ego?
That is a very, very interesting question. I like groups, and I know a lot about some groups. And what I find is that there's always got to be a certain amount of tension between certain members of the group in order for it to be interesting. You can't have one guy singing and everybody getting along and sort of falling asleep. That's boring. If you want a creative environment, you're going to have people that disagree, but you can't have them wanting to kill each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to keep a group together if you have creative people, because nobody wants to be, 25% of something.
They all want more. You know, even Lennon and McCartney, I remember a few years ago, there was an awful story. It was a little thing. McCartney wanted his name first. I mean, the guy's been, Lennon's been dead for 30 years, and he wants to change the order of their two names. Now, you know, that just shows you the struggle never stopped between those two guys. But that was the essence of the group. But that was the group, you see.
Yep.
That tension. So, yeah, I don't know. You know, it's really hard to keep a group together. And a lot of times economics will prevail and people will stay together because they can make money in the group and they can't do it anywhere else. A good thing to do is to keep the money straight so everybody knows that nobody's stealing. You know, have a good lawyer that tells everybody what's going on. And everybody knows that everything is honest. And then try to, you know, to keep the forces that are in disagreement at least below open hostility, you know. But that's what breaks groups up, you know. Eventually they, one guy says, I can't work with this guy, I hate him so much, you know. And, but that's what made it good.
You know, Don, I have averaged 7 years per band that I've been in playing drums. You've had all the same band of musicians. Tell us about that.
No, I have the same guys, and my musical director is Tony Migliori, who's been with me for over 35 years.
Wow.
So Tony is the one who brought on, you know, this person or that person, and then we liked him, and then we would, I'd say, well, I want to bring in a, you know, another guitar player. So, and plus I've made records in Nashville for, you know, 40 years, and I know a lot of the sidemen, and they say, oh, why can I come on the road? And so we all know each other, you know. So we have replacements for people, and they all come from Nashville.
And that's fantastic. Let's close today with some encouraging advice that you can give to young songwriters.
The thing you have to do is read a lot about what's going on, what's happening in the country, stories. The thing about, you know, the kind of song that you just mentioned is that is a character development. You know, you mentioned the Waving Man. Well, there you have a character, you see. And it
becomes a bigger thing when you write the story of the Waving Man. You know, he's a Vietnam vet. He did this, he did that.
Then it becomes an American story. So I like to start with, you know, writing about somebody or finding a situation that's interesting, and try to write and just, you know, write about that. And maybe it will lead into something that's a little bit more abstract, but, you know, go for that first. Try to find a human interest angle, I think.
Hey, thank you so much for taking time to be on Success Made to Last today. In closing, I just want to tell you, you are truly one of my heroes. And if you happen to see a guy singing in front of a Van Gogh painting, come over and join me.
Well, I sure will with all the other folks, right?
Thanks again, Don. It was truly an honor.
You're very kind, and we'll speak again someday, I'm sure.
That was the great Don McLean. We appreciate him being on our songwriter series. He is truly a legend. Make sure and buy his albums. They're coming up. They'll be released by Time Life. 11 albums remastered, and you'll get to hear all of his great, great songs. Hey, I'm Rick Tocchini. Thanks for joining us on Success Made to Last. We really appreciate you joining us to hear our celebrities, our guests, who are truly the best at what they do. And as we always say here, may you live the best version of you. Have a great week.
With eyes that know the darkness in my soul, shadows on the hills, sketch the trees and the daffodils.
So thanks to our sponsor, Edward Jones. They are our trusted financial advisor. And Edward Jones has been instrumental in helping us pivot our lives built around health, happiness, travel, and adding value to other people's lives. You can contact our advisor, Serban Marasini, by emailing him at serban.marasini@edwardjones.com. And thanks again to their sponsorship of this program.